Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Well, eaters of food, drinkers of water, breathers of air, let's get on with it. Right to the public health news and research roundup, where I collect all the great public health stuff, scour news and research so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, from the Insurance Journal, Roundup, not only Monsanto legal woe for Bayer, PCB claims still coming. The widening legal nightmare over Roundup weed killers isn't the only potential multi-billion dollar liability Bayer AG inherited last year when it acquired Monsanto Company. While thousands of damage claims over Roundup have grabbed headlines and hogged the attention of investors, the German conglomerate also has become a target of lawsuits by American states and cities trying to clean up toxic PCBs, a widely used fire-resistant chemical compound that the U.S. banned four decades ago. This could easily become another major litigation problem for Bayer, said Gene Agin, who teaches environmental law at Widener University in Wilmington, Delaware. Monsanto already spent almost $1 billion to settle past PCB claims, and new cases may be even more costly, she said. While there's no concrete estimate, these kinds of environmental cleanups can definitely run into the eight figures, and they can last a long time running up legal bills. PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, were used in electrical transformers, paint, sealants, and inks until scientists linked the chemical to cancer and other illnesses. The chemical got widespread attention in the 1970s when the government learned two General Electric Company plants had been dumping PCBs into the Hudson River for decades, turning 200 miles of the New York waterway into one of the biggest Superfund sites. St. Louis-based Monsanto made PCBs from 1935 until 1977. Bayer acquired the company last year for $63 billion. Monsanto made PCBs were discharged into waterways, including San Francisco Bay in California, the Sandusky River in Ohio, and the Skagit River in Washington, according to 18 pending lawsuits by states, cities, ports, and an Indian tribe. Dangerous levels of the chemical turned up near Baltimore's Inner Harbor and in reservoirs and ponds in New Mexico. According to the government lawsuit, internal company documents show executives learned of the health risks posed by PCBs more than 80 years ago and still hid the threat to protect profits. A 1937 Monsanto memo said animal tests show, quote, toxic effects from prolonged PCB exposure, Bob Ferguson, Washington State's Attorney General, said in a court filing last year. In another internal report, this one from the early 1970s, Monsanto officials wrote that the company couldn't halt production of the chemical because there was, quote, too much customer market need and selfishly too much Monsanto profit, according to Ferguson's suit. More than 100 bodies of water in the state are contaminated with PCBs, he said. In 1969, a committee at Monsanto warned company executives there were few ways to, quote, prevent the growing incrimination of specific polychlorinated biphenyls. from leading to the contamination of human food, particularly fish, the killing of some marine species, shrimp, and the possible extinction of several species of fish-eating birds, according to the Washington lawsuit. In another internal memo from 1969, Monsanto executive W.R. Richard outlined suggested cleanup efforts for PCB discharges discovered in parts of the Gulf Coast, Great Lakes, and San Francisco Bay, and suggested the company's legal strategy should be, quote, let government prove its case on a case-by-case basis, court records show. Despite these internal warnings, Monsanto assured state officials PCBs weren't a threat. Based on available data, manufacturing, and use, we do not believe PCBs to be seriously toxic. Editorial note, gag. The company told New Jersey's Department of Conservation in 1969. But a new round of PCB trials comes at a bad time for Bayer, says Elizabeth Birch, a University of Georgia law professor who teaches about mass torts. Recent trials over Roundup were won by plaintiffs in part because evidence showed Monsanto hid the health risk of the weed killer, and that could influence how juries view the company's actions in dealing with PCBs. This is as much a PR problem for them as a legal problem. Okay, next up in a related story from the New York Times, the EPA broke rules in shakeup of science panels, federal watchdog says. The Trump administration failed to follow ethics rules last year when it dismissed academic members of EPA advisory boards and replaced them with appointees connected to industry, a federal watchdog agency concluded. The agency, the Government Accountability Office, found that the administration did not consistently ensure that appointees to EPA advisory panels met federal ethics requirements. It also concluded that Trump administration officials violated EPA guidelines by not basing the appointments on recommendations made by career staff members. The House Science Committee is expected to raise the findings in a hearing. Also from the New York Times, toxic stew stirred up by disasters poses long-term danger, new findings show. New research showed that the extreme weather and fires of recent years, similar to the flooding that struck Louisiana and the Midwest, may be making Americans sick in ways researchers are only beginning to understand. By knocking chemicals loose from soil, homes, industrial waste sites, or other sources, and spreading them into the air, water, and ground, disasters like these, often intensified by climate change, appear to be exposing people to an array of physical ailments, including respiratory disease and cancer. We are sitting on a pile of toxic poison, said Naresh Kumar, a professor of environmental health at the University of Miami, referring to the decades worth of chemicals present in the environment. Whenever we have these natural disasters, they are stirred. And through the stirring process, we get more exposure to these chemicals. The toxic substances displaced during disasters are much more long-lasting and ubiquitous than I think people realize, said Gina McCarthy, who ran the EPA during the Obama administration and now directs the Center for Climate, Health, and Global Environment at Harvard. And we clearly haven't caught up in terms of our laws and regulations and the process of disaster response. Part of the problem and the urgency to better understand it is the ubiquity of chemicals in modern life, according to Thomas Burke, who was the EPA science advisor during the Obama administration. All of us have a little toxic warehouse under our sinks, in our garages, and maybe in the construction materials of our homes. When you do demolition in this country, there's a series of local laws to control contaminants. But when a neighborhood burns down, there's no asbestos control, there's no ability to really control the hazardous materials. The movement of toxic substances by storms and wildfires joins a long list of threats that climate change poses to American health, whether they be more severe heat waves or the spread of dengue or other ailments previously restricted to the tropics. What makes this threat different, researchers say, is the ability of many contaminants to persist in the environment or in people's bodies after the disaster has passed and to accumulate in with each new storm or fire. Typically, with these situations, you have a mixture, a toxic stew, said Audrey Miller, senior medical advisor to the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, part of the NIH. He said the danger is compounded because the mix of toxins could lead to unexpected interactions. We've been able to demonstrate human health effects in some of these, but that information is not adequately captured. As the dangers become better understood, governments need to do more to contain toxic chemicals during disasters. Rather than hoping these chemicals will harmlessly be absorbed into the environment, according to Kimberly Miner, a research assistant professor at the University of Maine who studies climate change and contaminants, when I was growing up, they were still saying the solution to pollution is dilution. We know now that's absolutely not true. Okay, from the Environmental Health Network. Researchers hand Michigan officials a tool to remedy environmental justice. Will they use it? For decades, community members living alongside heavy industry in Southwest Detroit's infamous 48217 zip code have pressed state environmental regulators to consider the cumulative burden of their exposure to a toxic stew of air pollutants. But the regulatory system, which takes a chemical-by-chemical approach, has fallen woefully short, leaving residents exposed to harmful pollutants such as sulfur dioxide, benzene, and chromium from an oil refinery, aging steel plants, and other facilities. The community is not alone, as the ongoing water crisis in Flint shows all too well. Now the state has an opportunity to rectify the environmental injustices borne by Michigan residents who live in heavily polluted areas. A new report released by the University of Michigan evaluates, for the first time, compound environmental exposures and social factors by census tracts statewide. It identifies environmental injustice hotspots, and in so doing sets the stage for policy action, such as the allocation of funds for remediation or the adjustment of regulatory approaches in at-risk communities, tactics that states like California and Minnesota have taken to remedy injustice. The researchers scored census tracts in 11 environmental and 6 social indicators, identifying 28 in Detroit, Grand Rapids, and Kalamazoo that ranked in the top 1% statewide for both high risk of environmental pollution and social vulnerability. For example, high concentration of minorities, high levels of poverty and unemployment, and low educational attainment. Census tracts in Flint, Saginaw, and Lansing scored in the top 5%. Notably, the average percent of minority people in the most polluted census tracts was 86% in comparison to the state population average of 29%. Similarly, 70% in the top 28 census tracts live below the poverty line in comparison to 30% statewide. This is the textbook definition of environmental racism, said Melissa Martinez, coordinator for the Michigan Environmental Justice Coalition. Meanwhile, the 48217, longtime community activist Teresa Landrum, is hopeful that the study will at long last move the needle. It's going to give the Whitmer administration an opportunity to step up if she's sincere. And another related story from Civil Eats. Burning sugarcane in Florida is making people sick. Could green harvesting change the game? A class action suit blames sugar companies for health risks in low-income communities of color as a result of burning sugarcane fields and urges more environmental and economical harvesting methods. They call it black snow, when the ash from burning sugarcane rains down on the small communities dotting the south shore of Florida's Lake Okeechobee. From October to April, ash and soot fall from the sky and settle on everything, blackening yards and blowing in open windows. Asthma, chronic bronchitis, and sinus problems plague area residents during the burning season, and local doctors usually ask patients how close they live to the sugarcane fields. Compounding the residents' health woes is a widespread belief that Florida sugar companies only burn around lower-income communities of color. At the same time, advocates believe that the companies practice green harvest, a method that both protects air quality and residents' health around wealthier, wider communities and near commercial districts. This process creates additional economic burdens or benefits by repurposing field waste that could otherwise get burned. In early June, a high-profile group of plaintiffs and lawyers filed a federal class action lawsuit on behalf of the more than 40,000 residents living by the sugarcane fields near Lake Okeechobee. The suit names a dozen sugar growers as defendants and blames them for health risks and lowered property values as a result of burning sugarcane fields. Residents say the decades-old practice of pre-harvest burning by sugar companies has caused unprecedented levels of respiratory illness and other problems from toxic smoke exposure. The small lakeside towns of Belleglade, Pahokee, and South Bay, referred to as the Tri-Cities, are designated by the state of Florida as a rural area of critical economic concern. Belglade's motto is, her soil is her fortune, but the fortune doesn't trickle down. Belglade anti-burn advocacy groups want the sugar industry to stop burning the fields and switch to green harvest to spare local residents. They point to the burn restrictions in place if prevailing winds would blow smoke towards Wellington, an upscale development 30 miles east of Belglade on the way to Palm Beach. Filled with multi-million dollar estates for the affluent and famous, Bill Gates has a home in Wellington, as do Bruce Springsteen and other luminaries. Communities like Wellington are seldom subjected to smoke from sugarcane burning. The Florida Forestry Service began issuing permits for cane growers to burn in the 1990s. When they received complaints about smoke and haze drifting east towards Wellington and Palm Beach, now they cannot burn if winds blow in that direction. Tri-City residents want those same protections. The lawsuit aims to require Florida sugar companies to harvest sugarcane without burning it, a technique called green harvest, which is practiced in sugar-growing regions around the world. Thailand wants to phase out cane burning over the next 3 years, and Brazil, the world's largest producer of sugar, mandated an end to burning in 2017. After the sugarcane leaves or trash is burned off, the cane is milled to extract the sweet syrup. The remaining fiber is called bagasse. With a green harvest, machines with cutting blades remove the outer foliage, which can then be collected to make biochar, mulch, and ethanol. Green harvest is often employed to reduce smog in cities, but advocates say it brings a number of economic and health benefits as well. Brazil has built a thriving industry using sugarcane trash to produce electricity, fuel pellets, ethanol and jet fuels, commercial mulch, and tree-free paper products, along with bagasse. Advocates say that green harvest is not only cleaner and healthier, it also creates jobs, and in the Glades community would be an asset. And yet, Glades sugar farmers claim advocates are trying to eliminate jobs by going to green harvest. A familiar story. But the Florida sugar industry is already working to benefit from bagasse. In March 2018, Telus, a company jointly owned by Sugarcane Growers Cooperative Florida and Florida Crystals Corporation, opened a $75 million state-of-the-art manufacturing facility in Belglade, offering biodegradable products such as plates and takeout containers made from bagasse. The facility is located by the sugar mill, powered by solar and renewable biomass from the mill, and, according to Telus officials, employed 50 people at launch, with a goal of hiring a total of 100 employees, 90% of whom will be local. The Telus facility is a rare exception for businesses seeking to locate in Belglade, residents say, because who wants to have to wash soot off cars every day? Some residents say this has caused a job shortage. One compared the practice of burning to hazardous, dirty coal jobs, and said the cane industry needs something similar to programs that have trained coal workers for clean energy jobs that pay better and support families. They could go to green harvest and stop burning. Our lives are worth that. Okay, next up from Vox.com. Study. The U.S. could have averted about 15,600 deaths if every state expanded Medicaid. The real impact of Republicans' rejection of Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. The United States could have averted about 15,600 deaths if all 50 states expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, new research suggests. The Affordable Care Act initially expanded Medicaid, the federal health insurance program for low-income people, to everyone making less than 138% of the federal poverty line. But a 2012 Supreme Court ruling weakened the policy, allowing states to reject the expanded program. As of 2019, 36 states and the District of Columbia have adopted the Medicaid expansions, and 14 states have not. And in a similar tact from the Washington Post, Trump proposal would push 3 million Americans off food stamps. The U.S. Department of Agriculture proposes new rules to limit access to food stamps for households with savings and other assets, a measure that officials said would cut benefits to about 3 million people. Senator Debbie Stabenow, Democrat, Michigan, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Agriculture Committee, said the proposed rule was an attempt to bypass Congress, which has blocked earlier attempts by the Trump administration to cut food stamps. This proposal was yet another attempt by this administration to circumvent Congress and make harmful changes to nutrition assistance that had been repeatedly rejected on a bipartisan basis. This rule would take away food from families, prevent children from getting school meals, and make it harder for states to administer food assistance. Stacy Dean, Vice President of Food Assistance Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, said limiting access to SNAP would overwhelmingly affect working families, seniors, and people with disabilities. It could encourage some recipients to spend down their savings or to work less to continue to qualify. Instead of punishing working families if they work more hours or penalizing seniors and people with disabilities who save for emergencies, the president should seek to assist them with policies that help them afford the basics and save for the future. To be eligible for SNAP, a household's gross income must be below 130% of the federal poverty line. In 2019, that works out to $32,640 a year for a family of four. Democrats pointed out that the benefit amounts to $1.40 per person per meal. Currently, households remain eligible with up to $2,250 in countable assets, such as cash or money in a bank account, or $3,500 in countable assets if at least one member of the household is age 60 or older or is disabled. Well, folks, that's the price we pay for a regressive government here. Okay, from fastcompany.com, we're leaving so much food on farms to just rot in the fields. You might be familiar with the fact that in the U.S., an estimated 40% of food goes uneaten. That's an alarming statistic on its own. This amount of wasted food correlates with waste in other areas. Around 21% of all water used in the U.S. and 18% of cropland is dedicated to food that will never get eaten, exercising a significant strain on already stressed resources. But most of the traditional research into food waste looks only at what goes uneaten at the distribution, retail, and consumer levels. These measurements capture how much inventory grocery stores toss, for instance, or how much consumers let go rotten in their fridge without eating. When a team of researchers at the University of Santa Clara set to figure out how much more produce is wasted before it even leaves the field, they found a much more dire picture. According to the research team, around 33% of food that's grown is either unharvested or left behind in the fields because the growers suspected it might not meet the specifications of their buyers. Growers often estimate the amount of produce they leave in the fields, but the Santa Clara team found that after conducting thorough analyses of 123 farms in northern and central California, that in-field food waste exceeds growers' estimates of losses by around 157%. Some produce categories are more prone to waste than others. These variations are often due to how uniformly a crop grows. Generally, growers are looking for a consistent product to offer buyers. This developing understanding of infield food loss could also give rise to solutions to address it. One might involve partnering with food banks to ensure unsold produce makes it to people in need. Santa Clara undertook the study in part after conversations with the Second Harvest Food Bank of Santa Clara and San Mateo counties, in which executives expressed concern that people living in poverty in the area were not able to access the vast amount of produce that's grown locally. Another solution might be creating a business market for this unsold produce. One of the problems is that there's insufficient market demand for imperfect produce, the kind that's most likely to be left in the fields. So there's little incentive for growers to pay for the labor to harvest it if they're just going to lose money and there's no guaranteed market. But some new companies are trying to correct that. Imperfect produce packages and sells wonky produce at a discount directly to consumers, and so far has rescued over 40 million pounds of food. The startup Full Harvest works with farmers to source imperfect produce and help them sell it to food and beverage companies that can incorporate it into products. Full Harvest CEO Christine Mosley founded the company after spending 15 years in supply chain management and witnessing tons of food go to waste. The fact that over 30% of produce grown doesn't even enter into the supply chain is the next biggest stat to come out about food waste, because the 40% we always talk about for food waste doesn't even include the food wasted on the farm. Okay, next from Science Daily. New research in mice helps to understand the risks around exposure to low doses of radiation, such as CT scans and X-rays. Low doses of radiation equivalent to 3 CT scans, which are considered safe, give cancer-capable cells a competitive advantage over normal cells in healthy tissue, scientists have discovered. Researchers recommend that this risk should be considered in assessing radiation safety. Every day we are exposed to various sources of ionizing radiation, including natural radiation in soil and rock, and important medical procedures like CT scans and X-rays. Low doses of radiation, such as exposure for medical imaging, are considered safe as they cause little DNA damage and apparently minimal effect on long-term health. Until now, other effects of exposure to low levels of radiation have remained hidden, meaning understanding the true risk associated with low doses of radiation has been difficult. Researchers have previously shown that our normal tissues, like skin, are battlefields where mutant cells compete for space against healthy cells. Now, normally, I actually don't really report on research in mice, but there's a lot of other evidence that basically ionizing radiation is not safe at any dose. It all contributes to our cancer risk. So I just want people to please ask your physician when you're given scans whether the scan offers ionizing radiation, and then to do an informed decision about what the risk-benefit ratio is for yourself, because some of these scans are definitely used when they're not needed or of little medical importance. Okay, now from Stat News, Fitbits and other wearables may not accurately track heart rates in people of color. An estimated 40 million people in the United States have smartwatches or fitness trackers that can monitor their heartbeats, but some people of color may be at risk of getting inaccurate readings. Nearly all of the largest manufacturers of wearable heart rate trackers rely on technology that could be less reliable for consumers who have darker skin. The potential inaccuracies have broad implications for the growing body of scientific research that relies on these wearables, as well as for the increasing number of people whose employers offer financial incentives or other benefits for using Fitbits and other trackers. Concerns about the devices also come amid a broader reckoning over whether new technologies are as objective as they appear, and whether implicit prejudices are shaping their development. It really is about the existing bias in medicine that we have already, said Khadija Ferryman, a cultural anthropologist who studies the social, cultural, and ethical implications of health information technologies. No matter what the technology is, there is evidence that inserting another tool, no matter how advanced it is, will likely continue on and continue to uphold the existing biases or exacerbate them. It goes to a bit of a deeper issue. When you start talking about who's in the room when these devices are being tested, who's in the room when these devices are being designed, and are the companies taking the time to make sure that the entire population is represented when they're developing this technology? We don't know, because the pace of the technology is extremely fast. The pace of research evaluating the technology is extremely slow. We need to understand if we can trust their outcome or not. Accuracy issues could also mean that an increasingly robust field of research into heart rates doesn't accurately reflect the heart rate information for certain individuals. Although numerous companies do indicate on their websites that their devices are not medically accurate, Fitbits are currently used in almost 300 clinical trials. Stanford University researchers also recently concluded the widely publicized Apple Heart Study of more than 400,000 participants, from which they reported that wearable technology can safely identify heart rate irregularities. However, the vast majority of studies performed that look into the accuracy of wrist-worn wearable devices do not take skin tone into account when they test their subjects. In the past, science hasn't particularly recruited as diverse of participants as they potentially should to be able to create generalizable results that will not only generalize to white Caucasian individuals, but will also generalize to people of different ethnic and racial minority groups. The potential inaccuracies could have an even bigger impact on people of color whose employers incentivize employees' use of fitness trackers with extra vacation days, gear, or even lower health insurance premiums. Already, big-name companies like IBM and Target offer trackers as part of wellness programs, and there are signs that employers may be beginning to make wellness programs, many of which include these trackers, mandatory. At one point, the West Virginia school system wanted to require teachers to wear them. Yale, too, was sued just this month over a program that would have charged anyone who didn't participate in its employee wellness program a $25 a month penalty. 21% of large employers who offer health insurance are already collecting information from their employees' wearable devices, a Kaiser Family Foundation survey found. Phil Gordon, a Denver-based attorney at the law firm Littler Mendelson, who focuses on workplace privacy issues, said the potential accuracy issues were yet another reason an employer should tread carefully before implementing any major wellness programs. It's a good example of a potential hidden side effect to technology, he said, and that's why it's so important for employers to really understand technology and the information it's generating before rolling out wearables in the workplace. Okay, going to finish with some good news. This from Science Daily. Seeing greenery linked to less intense and frequent unhealthy cravings. Being able to see green spaces from your home is associated with reduced cravings for alcohol, cigarettes, and harmful foods, new research has shown. The study, led by the University of Plymouth, is the first to demonstrate that passive exposure to nearby green space is linked to both lower frequencies and strengths of craving. It builds on previous research suggesting exercise in nature can reduce cravings by demonstrating the same may be true irrespective of physical activity. Researchers say the findings add to evidence that points to the need to protect and invest in green spaces within towns and cities in order to maximize the public health benefits they may afford. They also suggest the causality of this link needs to be investigated further. The study, published in the journal Health and Place, is the first to investigate the relationship between exposure to natural environments, craving for a range of appetitive substances, and the experience of negative emotions or feelings. It involved academics from the University School of Psychology with support from the European Center for Environment and Health at the University of Exeter. Leanne Martin, who led the research as part of her master's degree in Plymouth, said, "It has been known for some time that being outdoors is linked to a person's well-being, but for there to be similar association with cravings from simply being able to see green spaces adds a new dimension to previous research. This is the first study to explore this idea, and it could have a range of implications for both public health and environmental protection programs in the future." For the research, participants completed an online survey that explored the relationships between various aspects of nature, exposure, craving, and negative affect. Among other things, it measured the proportion of green space in an individual's residential neighborhood, the presence of green views from their home, their access to a garden or allotment, and their frequency of use of public green spaces. The results showed that having access to a garden or allotment was associated with both lower craving strength and frequency, while residential views incorporating more than 25% green space evoked similar responses. The study also measured physical activity undertaken within the same time frame that cravings were assessed, showing the reduced craving occurred irrespective of physical activity level. Dr. Sabine Paul, associate professor of psychology, added, "Craving contributes to a variety of health damaging behaviors such as smoking, excessive drinking, and unhealthy eating. In turn, these can contribute to some of the greatest global health challenges of our time, including cancer, obesity, and diabetes. Showing that lower craving is linked to more exposure to green spaces is a promising first step. Future research should investigate if and how green spaces can be used to help people withstand problematic cravings, enabling them to better manage cessation attempts in the future." Well, folks, that does it for today's show. If you'd like to review this show or queue up future shows or listen to past shows, please go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. "When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always." And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.